Welcome, listeners, to the NK News Podcast. I am your regular host, Jacko Zwetsloot, but today we have a special interview recorded by NK News boss Chad O'Carroll with Nat Kretchen, recorded in Washington, D.C. in early April. Don't forget that you can download or subscribe to our podcast not only at iTunes, but also Stitcher, SoundCloud, YouTube, and other podcast platforms. Also, you can save $50 off your NK News subscription by using the code PODCAST at the checkout. Nat Kretchen is the Associate Director at Intermedia, where he oversees research projects on Asia and hard-to-access populations. He has done extensive research with North Korean refugees and defectors and is also the lead author of the groundbreaking report A Quiet Opening, North Koreans in a Changing Media Environment, a study of the use and effects of foreign media on North Koreans conducted on behalf of the U.S. State Department. Take it away, Chad.
How did you become interested in North Korea?
Sure thing. Good to be with you, Chad. Interest in North Korea, I think, stemmed initially from my time studying abroad in China during university. And when I was there, there were a number of North Korean students, actually, who were also foreign students. And so that was my first exposure to North Koreans as people. Then didn't really pursue it in any kind of formal way until I got to grad school. SAIS, the grad school I went to at the time, had recently launched a Korea Studies Center. And so got involved in that. And that was kind of the initial thrust. But really, my work professionally in the subject came more from methodological training and survey research than it did from kind of an area studies perspective.
Tell us about your special interest in North Korea. Like, what are you talking about when you say that the survey stuff played a role?
My degrees are in economics, and I focused a lot on China. But in terms of how I kind of came to North Korea, it was essentially doing research for U.S. international broadcasters. Radio Free Asia and Voice of America both have North Korean services in which they broadcast content into North Korea. And there's a congressional mandate to do research on those services to make sure that U.S. taxpayer dollars are being effectively spent. But obviously, that's a very different ask for an audience like North Koreans than it is for just about anywhere else in the world. And so my first job out of grad school was essentially trying to work on that research program, figure out how do we conduct audience research amongst North Koreans. And in effect, the only proxy for that is refugees, travelers, and defectors. The research obviously comes with a ton of caveats. It isn't comparable to the kinds of research you can do in an open environment where you can construct proper statistical sample and actually, you know, go about modeling the population in an effective way. However, Intermedia, the company that I was working for at the time, had a long history working in Europe during the Cold War and essentially taking traveler data from Soviet citizens who were at the time able to do some kind of limited travel into Europe, doing relatively innocuous interviews with them, and then taking that data and modeling it back onto home populations in the Soviet Union. And years later, after the fall of the Soviet Union, when they were able to actually do research inside, they found out that the modeling that had been done by RFE and Radio Liberty during the Cold War actually matched pretty well to the underlying population statistics when they looked at listenership. North Korea obviously is a much smaller sample that we're working from. There's a lot more caveats that come with that sample in terms of the kinds of people who leave. There's a lot of things that we simply aren't able to correct for. That said, it is much better than just going with your gut or believing on faith that these things are either effective or not.
And I mean, in percentage terms, like how much of the North Korean population would you say is regularly tuning into these kind of stations?
So, of course, again, it comes with all the caveats of any numbers we produce are not necessarily representative of the underlying national population. But generally, we see somewhere from the high teens to the high 20s in terms of percentage of listenership. And I think the biggest takeaway from that is that even if it's an overestimation, it definitely is a strong indication that there is a meaningful listening population within North Korea. So even if we can't put an exact percentage figure on it, there are folks who listen, and those folks talk to others about what they hear.
If you want to listen to radio in North Korea that is not officially state broadcast, how do you do it?
So there are basically two ways. Traditionally, radios inside of North Korea, their dials were soldered to official stations, or they were built with kind of push buttons that toggled between official broadcasts. And so either you have an officially approved kind of fixed dial radio that you then kind of go in the back and manually tune to get non-approved broadcasts, and generally those are only AM accessible, so that limits you to the handful of AM broadcasts from abroad that are sent in with, you know, decent strength. Otherwise, you'll have a small, smuggled shortwave radio. And across the shortwave band, there are actually a lot of broadcasts being sent to North Korea these days, in the tens of broadcasts. And now some of those are, you know, Russian and Chinese in origin, but certainly there's lots of, there's religious broadcasts, there's South Korean kind of civil broadcasts, there's all the KBSs that you might get that are meant for South Korean audiences, and then there's a handful of both South Korean-based and US-based broadcasts that are targeted at North Korean specifically.
Now, if you want to listen to shortwave versus AM, is there any difference in terms of the quality of signal that you are able to get throughout North Korea?
The way that those broadcasts work, shortwave actually, somewhat kind of counterintuitively given the name, actually can be broadcast over much longer distances. The signals tend to be patchier, but they have, you know, national coverage of North Korea, given, you know, the amount of them that there are, how many frequencies are being used for broadcasting into North Korea, and just the nature of those signals. The limiting factor there is simply how many people have shortwave-capable radios, how many people both have acquired them or are willing to take the risk to have that kind of illegal device. If you get caught with your, you know, AM radio that's fixed that you've just been kind of, you know, toggling through the back, you're not likely to get in trouble in a way you will if they find an illegal shortwave radio on you. AM tends to be stronger, more robust broadcasts, but often the range is not quite as far, so there's pockets of North Korea that probably aren't within AM broadcast reach. And with AM, the difficult part is actually essentially being able to set up a broadcast tower within range. So there's a number of broadcast towers on the kind of the northern part of South Korea that are currently used to focus on North Korea, and those contain both South Korean broadcasts, a handful of U.S. international broadcasts, and some religious broadcasts.
So one of the things we did recently in our office, we're on the 23rd floor in central Seoul, and we got hold of a shortwave, well, multi-band radio, and of course North Korea is... 40, 50 miles away. Right. And there are a number of North Korean stations broadcasting south. What we learned is that South Korea is blocking a lot of those signals, but it's not on the shortwave band. And we were able to tune in to about four or five North Korean stations on shortwave. But what I noticed was it was very difficult. We had to, I mean, this was like a $120
nice radio.
We had to have a huge antenna coming out the window. It didn't work anywhere inside the office. We just got nothing. Only when we had this massive aerial coming out the 23rd floor could we pick up any signal, and it was terrible. It was very, very faint. And it made me think, if this is the conditions that one must endure to listen to radio, I wouldn't want to do that from my apartment in Pyongyang. Is that just unique to North Korea, to South Korea, that it's so difficult, or is it a bit easier in North Korea?
It is a bit easier in North Korea simply because you have more broadcasts, broadcasting with more power across more frequencies. And the nature of shortwave being that, you know, weather conditions and atmospheric conditions affect the signal, you know, if you have a lot more to choose from that are coming in with more power, you're likely to be able to catch a better one. That said, listening to shortwave radio is never, you know, an enjoyable experience from an aesthetic perspective. It's always going to be scratchy and just not going to compare to what you'll get even over AM, much less FM. I think that's something that we've really seen, is that the demographics of shortwave listeners tend to be more narrow than just about any other kind of media consumption in North Korea, simply because those are people who are definitely going for the information that is delivered only over shortwave radio, more or less. And they're willing to kind of suffer the kind of listening experience downside.
What's the safest way of consuming foreign information in North Korea?
It's getting less safe by the day. You know, we've seen as more of these kind of specialty task groups that draw from across the security bureaucracies have been kind of ever more present in local communities in North Korea, inspections have gotten very tight and it's very difficult. There are, you know, a number of ways that foreign media is consumed, and they all have lots of operational security protocols that have evolved around them for the North Korean people. It used to be that, like, entertainment media was less sensitive simply because of the nature of the content. It was viewed as less inflammatory than kind of the political content that you might get over radio. in recent years, that's been resensitized quite a bit as kind of crackdowns have been intensified. It's hard to say what the safest thing is. I mean, I think you kind of work back from the kinds of information that are in demand and the profile of the people who are trying to consume that media.
We hear, though, one thing that comes to mind that's not so safe is foreign cell phones being used to call along the border to China and other places because of the fact I've heard there is now detection equipment in place to try and catch people, so people have to keep the call short. Let's talk about the cell phone thing for a bit. I mean, that being an example of increased controls that are emerging along the border, how do families in South Korea, for example, communicate these days with extended family in the north?
Yeah, so I mean, I think this will probably eventually lead us into what I think is North Korea's super savvy new information control strategy. And one part of that is the way that they have really focused on border security along the northern border with China. Part of that, as you say, is pretty intense crackdowns on Chinese network cell phones. These have long been really important tools for cross-border traders and brokers and all the kinds of folks who are doing low-level, small-scale business with China or are helping bring people in and out of North Korea and need a connection to China. You're exactly right. There's IMSI catchers now that the Boibu and others have along the border that are able to catch calls of a certain duration. People are very much aware of that. I think we saw in the late Kim Jong-il era, a lot of folks who had a Chinese cell phone, and there were essentially kind of small economies around each of these cell phones, where they would allow, you know, close friends to use them for free, and they would like charge people to fees to use them otherwise. And I think that was probably a pretty good business. However, as the risk for doing that has increased a lot, they have become much more tightly guarded things that are used in a hyper risk conscious way to facilitate business transactions, more or less only. You know, it's only those folks now who are willing to look at that risk reward calculation and say, the money I'm going to make through this business is worth the quite large risk I'm taking.
So if you're, let's say, family in Seoul and your loved ones, an extreme example, live in Kaesong.
Yeah.
How, like with a Chinese phone, does that work? Because obviously the Chinese network has a limited range of, 10 miles, let's say.
Yeah.
So how do people communicate from outside of North Korea with loved ones very far from the border?
What's been interesting since the kind of more broad popularization of North Korean domestic cell phones is the ability to kind of link a domestic cell phone network with essentially the outside world via the Chinese cellular network. There's no real slick technical way to do that at this point because the North Korean network is so locked down and is, you know, infrastructurally separate from that of the Chinese. But what you can do is take a cell phone from China and flip a cell phone around in a domestic cell phone in North Korea and essentially have, you know, the earpiece to mouthpiece inverted. And in that way, you can technically talk to a loved one in Kaesong if they have a domestic cell phone or have access to one. Most of the time, folks who are speaking in that way are very careful to use quite coded language to make these calls sound relatively innocuous. Because at the end of the day, mostly what they want to know is, how are you doing? Is the family okay? Did you receive the money I sent? Which, you know, if you phrase that the right way, doesn't necessarily sound like it's coming from abroad. The other thing is that while the North Koreans certainly have the technical capability to have every phone in North Korea monitored all the time, they don't have the analytical capability, we don't think, to be kind of picking that stuff out of the ether. That's quite a big, you know, analytical ask to be able to do that. So certainly if you become a target of the government, they will know every communication you do over your cell phone. But if you're not on the radar as such, unless you're using some hyper-provocative sort of keyword in a text message or something, I think you're unlikely to be targeted through that means, at least at this point.
Now, one of the things that you touched on in your recent report on communications inside North Korea was the new fingerprinting means that the North Koreans are using to track files being passed from one device to another.
I think the important context for that discussion is that after the famine of the late 90s, the mid to late 90s, when the kind of socialist economy broke down, the North Koreans really lost a significant amount of control over information flow within their country, which up to that point, they had been very tightly controlling. And it's taken them a long time to be back in a kind of resource position where they can have a real go at reestablishing control. And I think the interesting thing they've done is rather than saying we're going to go back in time to autarkic high Kim Il-sungism information controls, they've decided to try to innovate forward, basically leveraging the massive technological advantage they have over their own citizens. What they've done is introduce domestic cell phones. This serves a number of purposes. I mean, it basically facilitates business transactions, which are useful to the North Korean government, who now, you know, needs market activity for economic gain, just like any other country, basically. The way these phones have been designed, they've ended up being very pro-security and pro-control for the North Koreans. In addition to some basic network controls that we knew about from day one on the phones, you know, the inability to call internationally, you know, 3G data while it exists in North Korea, basically only will load the Nodong Chingmun and a very, like, small set of services. It's far from, you know, the kind of cellular data use we have in most of the rest of the world. But the part that was only more recently kind of understood by those of us outside of the country are some of the device-level software controls that North Korea has instituted. And there's essentially two classes. There's a kind of censorship class of tools and a surveillance class of tools. And they're somewhat in conflict with each other because they attempt to essentially do different things. To do good surveillance, you have to give someone a little bit of space to do something wrong so you can see it. But the censorship tools are effectively designed to make sure that anything in the cell phone ecosystem is approved, that it's a very clean, clean system. And that is the side that seems to be winning out more. And the basic architecture for that is something that they call the signature system. It works a lot like the Apple App Store, if you're familiar with that. You know, in the Google Play Store, you can load a bunch of different apps, but in the Apple App Store, apps that exist there have to be approved and they're digitally signed and authenticated by Apple itself. That's effectively how North Korea on its Android cell phones treats every, not only application, but file. And so anything that you want to attempt to load on your phone either needs to have a validated government signature, or it needs to be kind of created by the phone itself, which there's a self-signature mechanism that exists for that. But it basically means that in the early days of North Korean cell phones, people were passing around short clips of South Korean dramas or K-pop files, things like that. And as soon as they turned on the signature system functionality, the ability to do that effectively went away overnight.
So if you record, say, a video of your uncle in North Korea saying happy birthday to your dad and you send it to him, what you're saying is that video will have some kind of fingerprint that said it came from your phone.
So, yeah, there's a watermarking functionality that's also been built in, which you would assume the purpose of that is to be able to create a string of attribution for anyone who has touched a certain file. And we can see that in practice. There's a couple of very interesting research papers that have looked at the way in which that is being done. And you can actually kind of, even from outside, you can scrape North Korea pages that touch the internet. And if some of that was created on the Red Star operating system, you'll be able to trace every computer it went through, even from the outside looking in. So that's definitely something that is happening. But that is somewhat separate from the censorship function of the signature system. But yeah, certainly for files that aren't blocked by kind of the censorship side of the system, they are being tracked by kind of more surveillance functions.
Now, that all being said, what do you think the future portends for smart ways to get information in safely to North Korea?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to consider is what is likely the broader trajectory that, you know, cell phones and the signature system and some of the surveillance technologies are pointing toward. I think what that looks like is the North Koreans attempting to move all communications onto sanctioned government networks that they have much more control over. Right now, lots of things circulate essentially offline from person to person via USB drives. And the North Koreans tolerate USB drives. They're not explicitly illegal, even though lots of the content that is carried over USBs would be illegal were it found. I think there is a long-term goal the North Koreans have that says, all right, USBs are illegal. The only thing you can use now are these messaging services, which we have set up for you. And if those messaging services run over state-controlled networks from your cell phone to your tablet to your computer running, you know, a version of Red Star OS, then effectively they have complete censorship control over anything that's going to be sent. And then they can simply outlaw USBs without, you know, kind of cutting off people's abilities to pass files around. Right now, there remains a window in which that kind of physical media being pushed into North Korea can continue to happen and will likely continue to have impact. But I think the long-term strategy of the North Koreans is likely to try to replace the services that currently exist over either broadcast technologies or through kind of non-network digital technologies to substitute all those with network technologies that they can control much more closely and then make everything else illegal. Essentially, you have to take the opportunity now while it still exists to push in as much kind of evergreen content as possible, but then also start to think about if this information control strategy really does come to fruition, is implemented completely, what are the potential ways that you start to crack that or to erode some of those controls?
Do you think enough is being done in both of those areas?
It's really hard. I think the North Koreans in designing this information control strategies have been very savvy. And also, we don't have great visibility. There are a handful of North Korean devices that are floating around outside the country that, you know, smart folks are analyzing and trying to understand a little bit more about, you know, the theory that and the technical implementations that underlie this information control strategy. The level of difficulty to push information into North Korea is only going to increase. And so there definitely needs to be a lot more kind of sober, resourced research that is going into understanding what the future of information controls is likely to look like. You know, if we are hoping as the U.S., as other concerned outside actors to really help facilitate information flows into and within North Korea, then it's going to take real resources and real kind of long-term commitment. You know, in a period of heightened tensions where the rhetoric has gotten quite bellicose and folks have been legitimately nervous about the potential for armed conflict to break out, a lot of folks have started to look to, okay, what are information options in a relatively hurried way? But the truth is, with kind of information-based strategies, there are long gestation periods. These things don't happen overnight. You can't, you know, send in one brilliantly composed piece of media and then everything changes. And so there has to be kind of sustained investment on both kinds of things to send in, ways to send it in, and ways to understand the North Koreans who are potentially receiving it.
Right. And so, I mean, right now, for example, we've got things like BBC cropped up. From what I understand, though, it's like half an hour of programming a day. It feels like that's a very low amount, given what you've just said, the scale, the gestation period. And I mean, how does VOA and RFA and others compare? Like, do we have 24-hour radio going in, or is it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have the exact amount of original weekly content that's being produced on the tip of my tongue. Effectively, when you think about all the rebroadcasting that's done, you know, North Korea is pretty blanketed with outside content. And that we hear in survey respondents as well, where on your given evening, you can kind of turn the dial and you're likely to run into some non-sanctioned radio content that's, you know, in Korean coming from the outside. But I think the bigger question is, the radio audience is likely to remain somewhat limited. It's never going to be a mass media thing, given, you know, like we said, the experience of consuming radio and the heightened risk profile associated with it. While radio, I think, is likely to remain important into at least the medium term, what are other options? And if the North Koreans are really trying to push back against the flow of South Korean dramas via USB and some of these things that we've come to think of as the norm as part of the North Korean information environment, what's the new thing that replaces that?
And what about legal ways to get information in? We don't hear so much discussion about that, but a few years ago, you used to hear occasionally about book donations, things like that. And from what we gather, there is real appetite on the North Korean side for certain types of technical, mm-hmm. agricultural information. What's your sense on the value of that kind of stuff?
I mean, I'm generally very much in the camp that we should be pushing in as much stuff as possible. I mean, the one potential caveat to that, and this is just as someone who spent too much time staring at images of, you know, the code behind North Korean cell phones, is that, you know, if we only push in computer science textbooks, then that's a pretty strategic win for the North Koreans. there definitely is a lot that we should be trying to move in outside of that very, very narrow kind of like easily nefarious uses come from this sort of information.
And just finally, what's your sort of outlook for this field? Like positive or...
It's been joked a little bit that this second North Korea information environment report that I put out last year was kind of like a big downer, was the Empire Strikes Back to the first more kind of hopeful report. That is definitely the case to some degree, simply because of the savviness and sophistication of the kinds of information controls that North Korea is implementing. That said, it does represent a step toward essentially a more modern and normal form of information controls, which we, you know, we have playbooks for from elsewhere. And there are smart folks who have worked on related problems in China, Russia, name your other spot, who I think are likely to start to get involved in the North Korea issue in ways that could be really fruitful to the issue space. And I think the thing that gets a little underappreciated in all this is that at the end of the day, even if the cell phones are super locked down, and even if the authorities do a pretty good job of making it harder for you to watch your South Korean dramas, what they have done is allow North Koreans to talk to each other in a much less siloed, much more immediate, and much more geographically dispersed way. And that just, that holds at least the possibility for, you know, a move toward greater civil society creation and kind of creation of internal constituencies in North Korea, which I think bode well for a bit more agency on the society side of that state versus society ledger.
Well, thank you very much.
Excellent.
Thanks for your time. Yeah.
Of course. Appreciate it.